morning is Dalton against Berkman. Mr. Gretsch.
May it please the court, I'm Eric Grush for Petitioner Lawrence Dalton. We raise two arguments on appeal. The first is that Dalton was denied effective assistance of counsel when his counsel failed to request a competency hearing. The second is that Dalton's guilty plea was not knowing and voluntary because he was not informed as to the maximum sentence he could receive. The district court granted a certificate of appealability as to the second issue, but not the first. We contend that the certificate should be amended to include both issues.
Just to be clear, you've been making this as an explicit request for an amendment of the certificate, as in the bold-faced page 7 of your brief, not an implicit request.
It is an explicit request,
right.
Your Honor.
Right.
In denying Dalton's habeas petition and finding the state court decisions to be reasonable, the district court made several fundamental errors. First, as to the ineffective assistance claim, the district court stated that petitioner's only evidence of incompetence is the fact that he attempted suicide. Although we think it is highly relevant that he attempted suicide 2 days before his plea, we relied on substantial additional evidence in the record as well. Unrebutted evidence in the district court record demonstrated that Dalton had hallucinations, that he had been in a mental hospital immediately before being transferred to Illinois to face charges, and that he would be returned to the mental hospital in Wisconsin after the Illinois proceedings finished.
Mr. Grush, can I kind of jump forward through some of this? Because I understand from your brief that you're making that argument, but this case suffers, as you yourself have pointed out, from an incredibly empty record at the state court level. And so in many respects, it all gets down to who bears the consequence of that fact. Some of these records are simply not there. And one issue that I'm interested in is whether you think the district court was obliged to hold an evidentiary hearing on the question whether Judge Maloney alerted Dalton at the time of the plea to the possibility of an extended term sentence. We have this sort of secondhand affidavit from the assistant state's attorney that there was such a warning. We have Dalton's affidavit and that of his mother that there was not such a warning. If that's a material issue on this case, is it the kind of thing that can be resolved through an evidentiary hearing, or do we just have to take the empty record for what it is? And maybe it's not material. Maybe by the time you work all the way through this and you apply the anti-terrorism and effective death penalty standards, maybe it doesn't matter. So I wonder if you could address some of those points.
Certainly. Whether, first of all, the record is to some extent non-existent, but there are some aspects of the record that were before the district court and are before this court, and the only aspects of the record that are before this court are the ones that support Mr. Dalton's case. The state's attorney's affidavit is not part of this case and is therefore not something that can be considered.
Do we know if that's part of the vanishing evidence or whether that just didn't get added to the record here?
I believe that it was. There are different parts of the vanishing evidence here, and I don't pretend to know at the various points when it disappeared. I don't know when that disappeared, but all I do know is that it's not part of the record here, and therefore is not something that under this court's precedent is something that can be considered or that can rebut Mr. Dalton's evidence. So we believe that on the record as it exists today, in this court and in the district court, a habeas petition should be granted
the big problem is that the evidence doesn't include a transcript of the guilty plea. And I have something of Judge Wood's concern. It's expressed in a rule that neither side talks about in their briefs, but maybe this is a good opportunity to. It's Rule 9A of the Rules on 2254 Challenges. And it says that if it appears that the government has been prejudiced in its ability to respond to a motion by delay in its filing, then the motion should be dismissed. And I would think that not getting your collateral attack underway for 7 years, during which time the transcribed notes are destroyed, is a good example of what 9A is about. Now, this with all this delay is pre-AEDPA delay, but 9A is about that problem. Now, it looks like it's saying that the consequence of delay and not having the record is supposed to fall on the petitioner, and what's supposed to happen is the petition is supposed to be dismissed.
I would have two responses to that, Your Honor. First of all, the delay, my understanding of that rule and of generally the Latches defense, which has not been raised at any point by the state in this proceeding, either in this court or in the district court.
Latches, this is a rule.
I believe that the rule is part of that defense, though, and I think the case law is clear that
Latches
the state bears the burden.
Common law doctrine. This is a rule.
Has the state ever cited 9A?
No, Your Honor. The state has not cited 9A, and I believe that the state bears the burden on that point. And if
well,
that has been raised...
Maybe that the state has forfeited any opportunity to rely on 9A.
And if the state had raised
but
it...
My question is, suppose we have to think about 9A. How should it... What does it do here?
If the issue had been raised, we would have submitted... Well, first of all, we have submitted evidence in the record. There is evidence in the record that Mr. Dalton did not file a habeas petition until 7 years after his initial plea because he could not obtain portions of the record. And
so you're arguing at least that he was diligent and was trying. You mentioned in your reply brief that you would be prepared to show he was trying to file something sooner.
Certainly, Your Honor, and we would submit record evidence that would demonstrate that he did so within a month after his plea, and that he tried on successive occasions many times over the next 7 years to obtain copies, and that in fact even on one occasion.
I'm puzzled by that. Normally, one files the lawsuit before you engage in the discovery. It sounds like you're saying you don't have to file the lawsuit until you've already succeeded in getting the documents you want. It seems like an inversion of the norm.
Mr. Dalton also effectively communicated to the state court that he wanted to file an appeal. In any event, he was also in a mental institution at the time he was doing this, and in fact not competent. And under that circumstance, His delay should not be blamed on him.
So, had this 9A issue been raised, I suppose one question that would have required exploration is how the 9A standards intersect with a defendant who's incompetent.
I think that is definitely one issue that we would address if the issue had come up.
Okay.
And this is simply not something that has been argued in the record before now, and if we were given the opportunity, we would certainly submit additional evidence on this point. But there's already evidence in the record that would demonstrate this fact, that the delay was not his fault.
So this all gets down to whether Judge Maloney told him there was a possibility of a 60-year sentence. Is there any serious question that relates to the 40 years? He expected 40 years.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And what's the length of his Wisconsin sentence?
It is a life sentence, Your Honor.
That's what I thought, yeah.
Without parole? He's eligible for parole. He has not been paroled, obviously, yet, but he is eligible.
How old is he?
I think he's around 60, but I'm not certain of that. I would say maybe late 50s.
From a pragmatic point of view, I realize, I mean, there are technicalities that are aside from this. Pragmatically, though, it's going to matter to him whether this extra 40 or 60 years is around after the Wisconsin sentence. Would this sentence be served?
It certainly will matter to Mr. Dalton if he's paroled in Wisconsin.
Okay.
And I didn't get a chance to address the issue of an evidentiary hearing. If for some reason the court believes that the evidence submitted so far is not sufficient, is not sufficient to warrant relief as a matter of course, we believe that at a minimum an evidentiary hearing would be required, and that's under the Hampton versus Liebach case that we cited in our brief. mostly because, I will actually, now that I see that the orange light is on, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Certainly, Mr. Gresh.
Thank you.
Mr. Quist.
May it please the court, counsel. Petitioner failed to shoulder his burden of establishing that he was not informed of the potential for an extended term here. It's necessary.
Was there any particular reason why Rule 9A was not raised?
It wasn't raised below, Your Honor. I apologize for not raising it.
Is there any reason?
No, there's no reason. In fact, our argument.
Just the switch.
Correct. Our arguments encompass, while they don't cite specifically 9A, they encompass the undue delay that is the basis for 9A. And I urge the court to look to the factual backdrop that was present in this case at the time the plea occurred. The time this occurred.
We have no idea what the factual backdrop at the time of the plea was because there's no record of the plea.
Actually, Judge, we do have a record of the factual backdrop. As Judge Wood pointed out, this case is here in a federal habeas proceeding, and accordingly, the record that is cited in the supplemental appendix presented by petitioner here on the post-conviction circuit court's denial of PC relief is the record before this court.
But it's the court's opinion. It's not the underlying transcript. And I just to throw one thing into the hopper, I'm very disturbed at the district court's characterization of Mr. Dalton's affidavit about what was said at his plea hearing and his mother's affidavit as self-serving. Now, I don't understand what that means. I mean, he was there in the room, competent to testify about what was said to him in that room. He says one thing. Obviously, the assistant state's attorney has a different recollection, so we can infer from what the court reports about what the affidavit says. So let's assume that's an accurate report. I don't see anything incompetent about that testimony. We abandoned a long time ago the common law's rule about a witness's disqualification for testifying in his own case.
Well, again, it goes back to the factual backdrop. There's a requirement under state law at the post-conviction stage. The defendant is required to attach affidavits or other record evidence to support his constitutional claims. The circuit court found that lacking here based upon the affidavit that was presented. It clearly credited, as it mentioned, the state's attorney's affidavit that she recalled that the defendant
What's
was so
clear
informed.
About that? I mean, I guess.
Well, the aspect that is unclear about his affidavit is, first of all, he states that he was specifically told prior to pleading that he would get 40 years for murder and 30 years for rape. That belies the notion that this was not some sort of a negotiated plea here, because what happened here, at the time that he pled guilty, the state announced its intention to seek the death penalty, that it would recommend the death penalty. He was already serving a life sentence in Wisconsin for a murder, a sexual assault, and a kidnapping. So he had an advantage to gain by negotiating a plea and avoiding the death penalty here. And in fact, the record that's before this court shows that the docket entries show that in fact the state nollied three charges in exchange for the guilty plea. And the circuit court judge specifically relied on certain things that were in the record before him and that are in the record that's contained before this court,
right,
his recitation.
You know, you're making an argument that a rational person, you know, might think that even 60 years was a good deal compared to the death penalty, but I'm telling you, we sit here every day seeing criminal defendants make decisions that don't necessarily strike us as the wisest of moves, whether it's deciding to represent oneself or whether it's deciding to go to trial or whether it's taking an appeal from both a conviction and a sentence where a retrial might actually make the sentence worse. I mean, there are all kinds of crazy things that people do. So the fact that he wasn't told about the 60 months, if indeed that's what happened, you know, I don't know, is troubling to me. And I'm also troubled, although I guess this was part of some generic record cleaning operation at the court, that the day after the post-conviction, suddenly all the records disappeared. The state has no policy for keeping files of active cases?
There's no explanation for that in the record, and that is very unsettling, I agree.
Yeah.
But again, because of the context of the procedural aspect of this case and the presumption of correctness that attaches to the findings here, this is a defendant who was represented by counsel. as the circuit court found, he executed a valid pre-sentence investigation report waiver, which under Illinois law at the time could only have been done if there was an agreed upon sentence between the parties. He indicates in his own affidavit that he knew certain sentences that he was going to receive for these particular acts that he committed, which would not have been done if there wasn't a negotiated plea. The court took into consideration the fact that he was found competent by a psychiatrist and that the court made a finding that he was fit for trial. All of these things and the post-conviction court's determination that the lack of other affidavits, and the district court echoed this, the lack of affidavits from his attorney who was present at the plea, or any other bystanders, or any other people who could have attested to
whether
or not.
Why do we need
that cut?
Yeah.
There are two affidavits to the effect that the judge said 40 was the max. Right? That one might think, if all Rule 9A problems to one side, would be enough to create a disputable issue, and then we'd go out and get affidavits from the attorney. And you're not suggesting that defendants can't get hearings in collateral attacks unless they have three affidavits as opposed to two, are you?
Not at all, Your Honor. In fact, what we're talking about here is whether the circuit court's determination that the plea was knowing and intelligently made was reasonable. It was reasonable.
And the Supreme Court has spoken in this respect of knowledge of the direct consequences of the plea, and there's plenty of cases that make it clear that the use of a later conviction to enhance a sentence and all sorts of other things aren't direct consequences. Surely the sentence you receive...
How much time you spend in jail is.
What could be more direct from the consequence of a plea?
I agree with you that's something that is not... In the court's decision in True Blood states that in dicta, and I believe that that's not a wrong statement, but that's not the standard here in habeas, whether it's wrong or incorrect.
No, but I'm saying the Supreme Court has said direct consequences, not us, not some other court of appeals.
Right.
And the Supreme Court has said, notwithstanding all of this deference, you get to apply a little bit of common sense to what the Supreme Court has said in its opinions.
But yes, you do. But the Supreme Court has never specifically said, nor has petitioner pointed to, a specific case that says that direct consequences require that
include
the
sentence.
I'm sorry?
The direct consequences.
Exactly.
There can't be anything.
there would have been a written plea agreement.
I'm not sure if there was a written plea agreement, Your Honor. But there certainly...
I know you're not sure, because... We don't have anything. But was it the practice, or by statute, or by custom, or whatever?
I'm not sure that was the practice at the time. Obviously, that would be a good practice, but there would have been a clear indication on the record that we don't have.
Your view was that they wouldn't have done the pre-sentence investigation in the way they did unless there was some concrete agreement.
They wouldn't have waived it. They couldn't under statute.
Yeah, well...
In addition, the judge is presumed to...
It doesn't necessarily mean it wouldn't happen. We do see from time to time arguments that judges, Judge Malone particularly, since he went to the slammer, did not conform all of their conduct to the law.
I agree,
but one might expect that document would be memorialized somehow in the prosecutor's files and the defense lawyer's files, completely independent of what's memorialized in the court's files. How about those sources of evidence?
That may have been the case. I didn't handle this case below, so I don't know what was researched in terms of finding things in advance of an evidentiary hearing that was never ordered here. What I can tell you is that the issue with respect to Judge Malone here is obviously a red herring, because as this court said in its en banc decision in Bracey, there needs to be some sort of nexus here between, there needs to be compensatory bias, and there's no allegation here. In addition, it would be ridiculous to presume that Judge Maloney, who was trying to cover up his bribed acquittals, would have,
We're not worried about that. But it does seem to me a little difficult to invoke the presumption of regularity to cover up the lack of a record in a proceeding presided over by a corrupt judge.
Well, on the one hand, you say you're not thinking of it, and yet you just mentioned it, so I'm not sure.
But there's a difference between using it as a ground of relief and thinking about it in response to your brief, which says, well, you know, presumption of regularity. If we don't have any records, we have to assume that everything was perfect. One doesn't think about that way for the judges who went to jail.
We have
I think Easterbrook is just saying it takes us back down to neutral.
To what the evidence shows.
And we do have a record. It's a far from perfect record, but we do have a record. And if this court was going to upend a situation where a prisoner pleads guilty, doesn't do anything for 7.5 years, tries to take back the plea and say that it was somehow not knowing and voluntary, and the notes have been destroyed because that individual has taken no effort.
Does the state of Illinois have a statutory method of reconstructing records that are missing?
There are certain statutory methods with respect to evidence in certain cases. There isn't, to my knowledge, a specific statutory structure with respect to keeping evidence. There is, on a case-by-case basis, the courts seem to determine what they do with evidence. And this is just such an unusual case because no action was taken following a plea for many years that the notes were lost.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you
very much, Mr. Black. Anything further, Mr. Crouch?
I have nothing further, Your Honors, unless we'll rely on
I'm asking the same question I just asked. Do you know of any statutory method of reconstructing evidence?
I know of no such statutory
method. I know some
method.
States do, Indiana, for example.
I'm not aware of any such here, Your Honor. Unless there are any other questions, we'd rely on our brief, which we believe address all of the arguments.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Grush, and we want to thank you and Sidley and Austin.